This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
Such stance or gesture shows that justice is still prevailing in the Republic of South Africa, and we are grateful because there was going to be a humanitarian disaster.
That's Luke Shvitsi, chairman of the Zimbabwe Immigration Federation, on a court decision to postpone for a year South Africa's effort to send migrants from its neighboring country home. Also, the UN says aid agencies still face challenges getting help to the needy across Sudan due to insecurity. And EU leaders are meeting to discuss aid to Tunisia in an effort to slow the departure of migrant boats for Europe. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UNOCHA, says aid agencies continue to face challenges getting help to the needy across Sudan due to insecurity in that country. UNOCHA's regional communications officer says millions of people have limited access to food, water, healthcare, and other basic services. Michael Atit has this report for VOA from Juba.
The UNOCHA says the ongoing fighting in Sudan has prevented humanitarian aid agencies from reaching families who need urgent support. Speaking to this program via a messaging application from Barcelona earlier today, Guyomar Pau Sole says Sudan's conflict has devastated the lives of civilians. She says more than 1,000 deaths and about 11,000 injuries have been recorded since fighting erupted in Khartoum mid-April.
This includes over 2 million people who have moved to safer areas in Sudan and over 506,000 refugees and returnees who have crossed the borders into neighboring countries.
Pau Sole says aid agencies, including local organizations, continue to deliver aid, replenish stocks, and provide services. She says about 85 humanitarian agencies have continued to provide humanitarian aid to 2.8 million people amid challenging environment.
Despite facing many challenges, including insecurity and bureaucratic impediments, humanitarian organizations have to continue to deliver aid, replenish stocks, and provide services whenever and wherever has been possible. However, much more is needed.
Pau Sole says aid agencies will require additional financial support in the coming weeks, given the ongoing fighting, growing humanitarian needs, and the rising cost of operations across some parts of Sudan. Adam Rijal is the spokesperson of the General Coordination, a body linking aid agencies and the displaced persons in Darfur. He told this program via a messaging application that hundreds of families from Al Janina in West Darfur are living in what he calls miserable conditions.
Food commodities have been consumed and almost all the bases and stocks of the aid organizations have been looted as well. Majority of civilians have fled to the local Himedia IDP camps, and they have crossed the border to neighboring countries.
Fatima Hakim, a woman rights activist working for the non-profit Darfur Women Union in South Darfur, is calling on aid agencies to urgently provide food aid to families in Nyala town who are trapped due to insecurity.
Our appeal to all workers of the regional and international aid agencies is to urgently move in and provide people with assistance. Otherwise, after a few weeks, people will not survive.
Nearly 2,800 people have been killed and more than 2.8 million displaced in the fighting between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his former deputy turned rival Muhammad Hamdan Dogolo, who commands the paramilitary rapid support forces. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
About 180,000 Zimbabweans working in South Africa who faced the threat of being kicked out of the country, even if their children are citizens, have welcomed a court ruling to stop the action. Pretoria's High Court ruled the government's plan to end their special residency permits was unconstitutional. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
The High Court's decision is a blow to South Africa's Home Affairs Ministry and a win for Zimbabweans, many of whom have been in South Africa for more than a decade. having left neighbouring Zimbabwe amid political and economic turmoil during former President Robert Mugabe's rule. To deal with the influx from across the border, South Africa initially introduced special permits to allow them to work, but in 2021 said it was ending the programme. The Zimbabwe Immigration Federation challenged the government's intention to force Zimbabweans to return home, and the group's chairman, Luke Shviti, on Thursday welcomed the court's verdict.
I welcome with two hands. The judgment ended yesterday by the High Court of South Africa in the favor of our organization, Zimbabwe Immigration Federation. And such stance or gesture shows that justice is still prevailing in the Republic of South Africa. And we are grateful because there was going to be a humanitarian disaster.
Shviti said the ending of the Zimbabwe exemption permits would have caused a huge exodus and meant many families in Zimbabwe being supported by a breadwinner in South Africa would have been pushed into greater poverty. The court ruled that the permits would be extended for one more year. After that, Shviti said his organization would launch another application. Siya Khoza, spokesman for South Africa's Minister of Home Affairs, said it was uncertain whether the government would appeal.
The minister is still studying the two judgments and taking legal advice on them. He will, in due course, respond fully to them. In the ensuing communication, he will further outline steps that will be taken, including appeals, if any.
Silas Sabanda is a driver who has been living in South Africa for about 20 years and currently holds an exemption permit.
When there was no verdict yet, we remember we're still in the dark. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't move. We were worried that maybe we'd lose whatever we'd done, especially for those who had jobs and who were working. But at least now we are given the space so we can do things properly and proper planning as well. So it was a big relief for most of us.
As Africa's most industrialized economy, South Africa is a favored destination for Zimbabweans and other migrants from the continent. There have been incidents of xenophobic violence, however, with South Africans targeting other African nationals. Last year, a Zimbabwean man in Johannesburg was killed by a mob. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Cameroon is cracking down on the smuggling of cocoa, cotton, and other cash crops to Nigeria by temporarily banning the legal trade. Since announcing the ban 2 weeks ago, authorities have sent hundreds of police to the border and seized scores of trucks there. But Cameroon's struggling farmers are protesting the move, saying it's more profitable and safer to sell their goods to Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Cameroon police and customs officials say they blocked scores of trucks that attempted to smuggle cash crops in the past 2 weeks from northern towns and villages into Nigeria. Police say they seized wheat, corn, rice, cocoa and cotton since launching a temporary ban on all crops export to Nigeria on June 13. Cameroon's Ministry of Trade says the ban was needed as it loses $165 million each year from the smuggling of cash crops to its northern neighbor, 60% of the total trade. The government ordered hundreds of police to the border and to track down at least 12 trucks that fled from authorities. Cameroon's farmers say the ban will be hard to enforce along the porous 2,000-kilometer-long border. Baba Amadu is a spokesperson of the Association of Cereal Farmers on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. Speaking by phone from the border town of Mora, he says many farmers are not able to store their crops for selling in Cameroon. Amadu says Cameroon does not have enough facilities to protect cocoa, wheat, corn, rice and sorghum from moisture, dust and insects or swarms that invade and destroy crops after harvest. He says farmers prefer selling their produce to a ready Nigerian market because rice, corn and raw cotton processing equipment is scarce, old and there are regular power cuts. Amadu says selling to Nigerian merchants is also more profitable and he cites the example that farmers can get about 20% more for a 50-kilogram bag of unprocessed rice. Cameroon's government complains it pays subsidies to farmers to sell their cash crops locally and at agreed prices. The ban was announced by Cameroon's Trade Minister, Luc Magouan-Barga-Tangana. He says they are aware of the challenges for the government and the farmers.
One of the challenges, of course, is the inadequacy of post-harvest processing and storage facilities. The government has developed some programs to process 40% of our total production. And now, with the prohibition of child labor and the prohibition of deforestation, those people who are destroying forests to create new plantations will not have access to the international market.
Cameroon's Ministry of Agriculture says illegal cocoa exports to Nigeria spiked after Anglophone separatists in 2017 launched a rebellion against Yaoundé. The rebels are seeking to create a breakaway state from Cameroon's French-speaking majority. Chevron Array is a cocoa exporter in Kumba, an English-speaking southwestern town. She says the rebels stopped them from selling the cash crops to French-speaking towns.
With the separatist crisis, enterprises no longer come to buy cocoa. Fighters destroyed vehicles belonging to companies that attempt to buy. Cocoa farmers were abandoned to themselves. The easiest market they could count on was across the border in Nigeria.
Cameroon authorities say the military is protecting farmers from rebels so the domestic trade can resume. But farmers say smuggling to Nigeria will continue as long as their options are facing separatist violence and lower prices at home or risking illegal exports across the porous border. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman is at the U.S. Supreme Court at this hour, where a 6-3 ruling has come today gutting affirmative action in college admissions.
Protesters have converged in front of the U.S. Supreme Court after its split decision announced Thursday that colleges and universities cannot continue to consider race as part of their student admissions decisions. The practice, known as affirmative action, in general was intended to increase the number of Black, Hispanic, and some other minority students on campus. Taking race into account has been more common among America's most selective universities. Those schools, because of their popularity, have to turn down most applicants. 9 U.S. states have banned the use of race and admissions policies in their public colleges and universities, including California and Florida. The Supreme Court was asked to consider a pair of cases advanced by a conservative legal strategist. One case accused Harvard University of unlawfully using its admissions policy to discriminate against Asian Americans. The other claimed the University of North Carolina unlawfully discriminates against white and Asian American applicants. The Supreme Court, for decades, for the most part, had largely allowed admissions policies that took an applicant's race into consideration. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the Supreme Court.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please head to voaafrica.com, and there you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A British court ruled today that a government plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is unlawful, delivering a blow to the Conservative administration's pledge to stop migrants making risky journeys across the English Channel. In a 2-1 ruling, the Court of Appeals judges said Rwanda could not be considered a safe third country where migrants could be sent. Speaking during a session of the Court of Appeals, Lord Burnett, the Lord Chief Justice, said there is a real risk that persons sent to Rwanda will be returned to their home countries where they faced persecution or other inhumane treatment, even if they have valid asylum claims. In Kigali, journalist Eugene Uwimana spoke with people about the ruling. Ali Ruzwiga is a vendor, and he disagrees with the British court's decision.
They could be good to send them here. It would be good because we have many migrants here in Rwanda, from Ethiopia, from Libya, from Burundi, and many more. So I think being honest, it's not a right decision, because as our country is always positive for us and for everyone around the world.
Patrick Muniza is a teacher of history and political science at Kigali's Glory High School, and he thinks the ruling shows a degree of disorder in the UK.
I must say that I did not see this coming. From the very first day when this deal was announced, I saw many UK officials coming to Rwanda. Many even visited the facilities that will accommodate the asylum seekers. And when they leave, they all say they appreciated the facilities and everything is in place. But I liked the announcement of the UK Prime Minister that the government will appeal. But I think it shows that there is some hidden hand that the UK government is unable to see or deal with, because honestly speaking, you cannot say that a country which is receiving asylum seekers from Libya is not fit for being a part of the disordered migration systems. I think this again shows that there is growing political instability in many Western countries.
British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said he fundamentally disagrees with the Court of Appeals ruling and his government will appeal to the Supreme Court. Earlier this month, he pledged to stop the boats, a reference to the overcrowded vessels that make the journey from northern France carrying migrants who hope to live in the UK. The Rwandan government also took issue with the ruling, saying Rwanda is one of the safest countries in the world. The UK and Rwandan governments agreed more than a year ago that some migrants who arrive in the UK as stowaways or in small boats would be sent to Rwanda, where their asylum claims would be processed. But a European Court of Human Rights ruled that that was illegal last June. At the site of one of the world's biggest slave ports, a museum designed to simultaneously hold the sensations of trauma and joy opened this week. It honors the many thousands of Africans forced to leave home under barbaric conditions, and it celebrates their American legacy as well. The International African American Museum opened on Tuesday at Gadsden's Wharf in Charleston, South Carolina, where more than 40% of enslaved Africans came to U.S. shores. Columbia University Professor of History Christopher Brown explains to me why this museum opened at Gadsden's Wharf in the U.S. southern city of Charleston.
Charleston was, in some ways, the Ellis Island for Africans brought to what became the United States in the 18th and early 19th century. I mean, close to half of enslaved Africans who came directly from Africa passed through Charleston. And Gadsden's Wharf was one of those places where slave ships unloaded their human cargo. So, it really is a significant place as far as the gateway to slavery for so many African people who came to what became the United States. So it's very appropriate that has been established in Charleston in that particular location.
The museum includes an ancestry research center. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's an exciting move for these kinds of museums to really take seriously the Africanness, the African background of enslaved men and women. A history which is often, deeply obscured or romanticized and generalized in ways that don't provide much in the way of cultural specificity. The work that's gone on in the Atlantic slave trade over the last half century has really allowed scholars to know much more about where people came from, when they arrived, where they departed from in Africa. That resource at the museum is going to galvanize, I think, investigations into the individual backgrounds of men, women, and children who arrived. I mean, there's no registers of individuals. There's no sort of census that was taken at the time of people asking, who are you? Where are you from? What's your name? How old are you? That kind of information, which occurs in other migration registers for other people, was never made at the time. But there's a lot more information out there than scholars have realized, and I think the museum is going to facilitate those kinds of investigations.
In the books that I've read, the way it worked was when they were sold, the people they lost their last names, they lost, their family too. So many of them were separated from their siblings or even their children. So this has got to be a lot harder than say, Europeans who came over and went through Ellis Island.
That's right. And it also happened at the point of purchase on the West African side. The European merchants who sailed up into West African waters had no interests in the names of the people who they were acquiring. They had no interest in their cultural affiliations, their national affiliations. You know, what they were doing was purchasing men, women, and children who, from the standpoint of the slave purchasers, you know, were just cargo, were anonymous people who could just be, you know, traded as commodities. And so when people reach Charleston, you know, those connections are just further obscured.
A lot of people must have died either on the boat coming over or at the wharf.
Yes, yes. Over the course of the Atlantic slave trade, it varies from between 10 to 20% of folks who perished during the crossing. Obviously, on individual ships, it could be much greater than that or perhaps a little bit less than that. But, you know, in most instances, those who did survive arrived quite sick, dehydrated, famished, beaten and bruised, not to mention severely dispirited by what had happened and what was happening to them.
Aside from trying to help people connect with their relatives and their ancestors, is it also meant to let people try to understand what their culture was before they came here, being forced into slavery?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, for many African Americans and people who are not African American but curious about the history of Black culture and Black life, you know, the question of where have we come from and what was lost in the passage is something that has always been a very powerful question and set of concerns. And, you know, a museum like this, I think, further makes possible the inquiries, provides some answers for those, for that curiosity.
That is Christopher Brown. He's professor of history at Columbia University. He was speaking to me yesterday from New York City. The new modern art gallery at the Denver Art Museum includes two painters from Ghana. VOA's Scott Stearns gives us a look.
Denver Art Museum's newly renovated modern and contemporary art gallery features a wall of double portraits that includes the Henri Matisse painting Two Sisters and Martin Maloney's Overexposed. Added to the collection are two works by artists from Ghana. Rory Padakins, the gallery curator.
We curiously have this collection of double portraits, and I thought it would be interesting to kind of celebrate that, to celebrate connections between people, literally that are happening within the painting itself.
Ghanaian painter Cornelius Anor's Aboke was acquired by the museum last year.
The ways in which he's created the image is that he's also applied fabric to it. So there's these textiles from Ghana and from Africa in general that's also added onto the painting itself, and it adds this kind of richness.
Ghanaian painter Emmanuel Taku's Black Halos reflects the artist's childhood love for Superman comics.
As he got older, he realized that he never saw characters in these comic books that looked like him. And so as an artist, he wanted to sort of portray all of his figures with this kind of superhuman strength. And so they're usually pupilless. It's at that point where the Superman character becomes his most powerful.
The reinstalled gallery draws from a collection of more than 8,000 pieces. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Denver.
European Union leaders are meeting today to discuss aid to Tunisia in an effort to slow the departure of migrant boats for Europe. The French news agency AFP reports that European Council Chief Charles Michel said leaders at the Brussels summit will discuss implementing decisions made at a meeting in February. Those decisions include an offer by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen of more than 1 billion euros, that's about $1.1 billion, if Tunis meets International Monetary Fund conditions for a loan worth nearly $2 billion. And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, go ahead and visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabaro, and engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.